Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The story that we get about Afghanistan is fairly predictable. It's a country unchanged, filled with rugged mountains, burning deserts, and tribal people frozen in time. That's about it. But today's guest, Tamim Ansari, reminds us that the history of Afghanistan is not invasions, occupations, and interventions. It has a story of its own, which is often interrupted by invasions, occupations, and interventions by Great Britain, the Soviet Union, and the United States. In his new book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan, Tamim Ansari writes, quote, "Five times in the last two centuries, some great power has tried to invade, occupy, conquer, or otherwise take control of Afghanistan. Each intervention has led to a painful setback for the intervening power. And the curious thing is, these interventions have all come to grief in much the same way and for much the same reason. As if each new power coming into Afghanistan has vowed to take no lessons from its predecessors," end quote. Tamim Ansari is a San Francisco-based writer, author, and director of the San Francisco Writers Workshop. He's published essays and commentaries for a number of publications, including TomPaine.com and the San Francisco Chronicle. He's the author of many books, including Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes, and West of Kabul, East of New York. He was born in Afghanistan in 1948, moved to the U.S. in 1964, and he was last there last spring. And Tamim joins me here in studio. Hi, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So first off, there are a lot of books about Afghanistan, and a few written about the history of Afghanistan. Why did you try to tackle this subject? But what's a little different is it's told through the eyes of Afghans.
Well, that's probably the main thing. There are a lot of books about Afghanistan, but they're so emergency crisis oriented. It's like, oh, this thing is happening now. What can we do about it? And I grew up in Afghanistan, and I've been in a constant relationship with Afghanistan, even though I've lived here most of my life. And so one thing is that I think I know something about about Afghanistan, and I wanted to put that out there. And the other thing that I was very aware of is Afghanistan sporadically exists in the consciousness of the world. It exists when there is an intervention, and when that intervention fails or ends for whatever reason, then it doesn't exist until the next one. Mm-hmm. So if you're an Afghan and you're involved in the fate of the country, you're aware that there's a thread that goes all the way through. This is not the story of this country, is not the interventions. And each time it comes back into the consciousness of the world, you feel like there's something missing from the conversation. So that's why I wrote this book.
And your father is Afghan, your mother is American.
That's correct, yeah. My mother was actually the first American to marry an Afghan.
It's a really interesting program that you describe in your book about Afghans going to school in the U.S. and then what happened to a lot of these men bringing back women from the U.S.
Well, you know, that was one of the moments in Afghan history, part of the ongoing struggle in Afghan culture, resulted at some point in the government deciding that they had to send students abroad to acquire the education they would need to develop the country. Now, why the government would want to develop the country, that's a whole other question. But they sent these kids abroad. They came back. My father was the first one to marry an American against orders from the royal family. They said, don't do this. He brought her back. Then after that, other ones came back with foreign wives. And so an Afghan foreign community, small one, began to develop in Afghanistan. And, you know, that was part of the growing class of what I've called the technocrats in Afghanistan, which was a whole new class in Afghanistan. It was educated. It was not necessarily of the royal clan. You know, there were people of all the different ethnic groups and are that made their way into this technocratic class. So it was the, you know, progressive, advanced, modernizing segment of the culture. What's interesting about that is that, for example, my family, part of the reason why my father was at the head of the line to get one of these scholarships, aside from being, you know, talented, smart guy, I'll put that in there, but also because my family had a certain prestige in Afghanistan. Why? Because we were a conservative religious family, and it was the conservative religious prestige of my family that resulted in my father being sent abroad and becoming part of the unconservative, liberal, secularizing part of Afghan society. I think that's an interesting irony.
Hmm. Well, and so what's interesting is when you wrote about the picture, the visuals and the stories that we get in the West, it really doesn't seem to change. And what goes through your mind when you look at how the media portrays Afghanistan?
What goes through my mind is that I'm immediately plunged into my sense of the ongoing story of Afghanistan, which is one of constant turmoil and change. It's true that one of the impulses of Afghan society is to try to get back to an imagined, changeless, ancient society. Hey, that's not absent from American society either. You know, part of the conservative impulse is always to go back to some imagined time when nothing changed. Actually, Afghan society, both in the countryside and in the city, each of those is dynamic. And then for the past 100 years, the struggle between the urban and the rural cultures has been a dynamic, change-generating and drama-generating mechanism or process in Afghan society.
Because what you really do in your book is you sort of present an arc. Mm-hmm. The founding sort of Afghanistan through the present. And you also say that what we don't often hear in the West is that there is a major divide, but we don't really go much deeper.
Right. And what we don't also appreciate is that the part of the divide, the other part of Afghanistan, the urban part, the part that is in struggle with the conservative, religious, rural part, is also Afghan. And it's not an inconsiderable part of Afghanistan. It's not as if those are... There is a certain amount of, you know, the West comes in and puts in a puppet. Okay, so that does happen. But within Afghan society itself, there is a large group of people who are pointed outward and have the impulse or the desire to bring about certain changes in the society. They're not Afghans. They're Afghans, too. Mm. So I forget what your question was, but...
Oh, no, just the divide that you write about. Yeah. We don't really get that much depth here,
right,
about that divide.
The divide we don't get much about, and we also don't get much about the fact that the Afghan story has been one of struggle over these issues for over 100 years, and the struggle is equally matched. I think one of the... one of the kinds of narratives that I hear is that, oh, when the West leaves, then the Afghans or perhaps the Taliban are going to just take over because they're tough guys from the they have beards and they have guns, and the city is just a bunch of wussy people who are living on the dole, and they'll be overwhelmed, and then the Taliban will come back and put execute women and shut down the schools. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. No, this struggle has been going on in Afghanistan for a long time. And the other side, the urban component of Afghan culture, excuse me, those guys are not wusses either. You know, they're all Afghans. They're all kind of tough. And I'll go the other part of it and say, out in the countryside, there's plenty of people who are they might have beards, but they're sweet guys. So it's not all divided one way or another.
We're speaking with Tamin Ansari about his new book, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan, Games. It's called Games Without Rules. And Tamin was born in Afghanistan in 1948. He moved to the U.S. in 64. He was last there last spring. And this book is really a people's history of Afghanistan. It goes beyond the sort of the stereotypes that we see and hear here in the West. And we've done so many shows about Afghanistan over the years. What don't we still fully understand? What questions do you have about Afghanistan, its history, it's the present, and where it's going? Because the other thing you argue is that we often hear about the despair, but we don't really know where this is going to end up.
Well, we don't, and what we don't see, although, you know, part of what's going on in Afghanistan definitely is conditioned by the fact that money has been pouring in from the outside, and Afghans are very busy finding ways to get close to it so they can channel as much of it as possible of it into their pockets. So it's created the situation where there are actually very rich people in Afghanistan, and there are also very, very poor people in Afghanistan. So that's correct. But along with all that, you know, the rich people and those interests in Afghanistan, they're busy putting in all kinds of stuff. You know, they're putting in cell phone technology that's very good. Computers are finding their way out into remote villages. Afghanistan has a vigorous media now. And in some ways, I would say there's aspects of the news media in Afghanistan that's more crusading and more daring than what I see around here.
Wait, elaborate on that.
Well, you know, for example, I'll just give you one example. One of the premier stations is Tolo TV, and they, here's one thing they did. I think it was last year sometime, there was an attack on a bank in Jalalabad, the city of Jalalabad, and many innocent people inside that bank were killed. And the next day or shortly thereafter, these Talibanist voices out in the, wherever they are, they claimed credit for this. They said, yes, we did this. But this bank had security camera, and that security footage that showed what was going on in the, it caught what was going on when these people were being killed, and Tolo got a hold of that and they broadcast it. And the sight of what went on in that bank was so horrific that public revulsion just was palpable. Mm-hmm. So palpable that after that was shown, that these voices of the Taliban were saying, actually, we had nothing to do with that. That wasn't our operation, okay? So that's one example. Now let's look at the other side. In this last year, the finance minister of Afghanistan, these guys dug up the information that he was banking great sums of money in foreign banks. And, okay, that's not illegal, but they said, where is he getting the money? And they compared his salary to the amount he was banking, and they said it doesn't match up. Well, then he was that's put the spotlight on this guy, and he was in trouble. Then he said, well, I was a lecturer for Carleton University in Canada before I was here, and they paid me handsomely, and I saved a lot of money, and that's where I... And they went and they got his pay stubs from Carleton, from that university, and they broadcast that. Hmm. And they said, here's how much the guy was making. How does that add up to? And then they broadcast his bank forms for putting his money in. That's really just fierce reporting, and it's not letting go. And it's going after both the savagery of the Taliban and the corruption of the high government officials. I say that's pretty good.
We're speaking with Tamim Ansari about his new book, Games Without Rules, and we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about Afghanistan, its history, its present, and where it's going? What about misconceptions and the overall story that we get in the West? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So before we talk about the past, you've got some really interesting information about Chinese investment, the NGOs. What will it take to break from this narrative and the obsession with the past?
I didn't quite understand. From the obsession with the past?
With the past that we get in the U.S. It's always been like this.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
Right? So invasions, occupations, it's just this is the way it is.
Well, you know, one thing is that we are not going to break with Afghanistan, and it's not going to recede from the consciousness in the way that it has in the past. So that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen because right now, it is, again, a crossroads of strategic, jockeying that matters. And part of that is, as you said, it has the minerals, the Chinese are coming in. The U.S., for whatever reason, is in permanent state of crisis with Iran. And Iran is one of those countries that's looming into Afghanistan. And so that's always, in the near future, that's going to be that's going to be one of the concerns here. It seems to me that the greater the extent to which Americans have actual interaction with Afghanistan, the greater the extent to which Americans are in Afghanistan, interacting with Afghans, the more they'll see that it's a country with many aspects. Right now, my experience was that Americans in Afghanistan, both the army and the civilians, live in green zones. Mm-hmm. You know, they live behind sort of walls, and the interaction is not that great. It's not that voluminous or whatever. They're cut off from each other by barbed wire and concrete barriers. So what it will take is partly taking down those barriers and having there be more people-to-people interaction.
And that hasn't changed, because you write that most foreign invaders have been completely cut off from the Afghans, and one of your main argument is that the latest foreign invader never learns from the last foreign invader.
Right, and the compound, the green zone idea was exactly characteristic of the British occupation of Kabul in 1839-1840. They also had, walled cantonments, and they lived inside that, and within that world, they had a simulacrum of British life. Here, I wasn't in the green zone when I was there, but I was told before I went by people who go back and forth, you shouldn't wear, the native tribal dress, because you'll stick out like a sore thumb. You got to have, the way I'm dressed right now, jeans and so on. And they also spoke of, coffee houses and Starbucks. And I didn't see any of that, because that's in another part of, and where I was, Kabul is now this huge city, 5 million people, maybe bigger than that, who knows? And I saw nobody that wasn't dressed in baggy pants and long shirts tribal, native, Afghan-looking clothes. And I'm going, where do you have to be in this city to think you'd stand out being dressed that way?
Well, what did you hear from the locals about what is happening right now and their interaction or not much of an interaction with the Americans?
Well, the locals that I spoke to, their reaction is complicated. Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, it is true that Afghanistan has not developed a sustainable basis for an ongoing economy during these years that we've been there. So there's lots of money coming in, and people are living off that money, but the fear is what happens when that stops, if it stops. At the same time, I was kind of surprised by the extent to which people whose lives are staked on the American presence, pretty much, their businesses there, whatever, depends on the whole idea of America being there and the money coming in. Even those people had these really rather, some of them had rather extreme ideas about what America's doing there. I heard some strange conspiracy theories. I heard that American troops are over there mainly to destroy shrines and I think back to the incident that occurred when the soldiers incinerated the Qurans. And what really stuck out for me was that the response here about that was not nearly as freaked out as I thought the episode probably demanded. Mm-hmm. That was a much more extreme thing than people here seem to get. And later there was talk of how we're going to respect religious materials now, and we're going to, learn to handle those more carefully and stuff. What stuck out for me about that was no distinction was evident in those comments between the Quran and, say, the writings of a saint. Those are absolutely different categories. That doesn't the freaked outness about incinerating the Quran does not apply whatsoever to the book of sayings of some saint. Quran is different. So now it occurred to me that then all of that happened, and yet still, we don't know why that was such that episode aroused such passion. So now I look at, for example, the green on blue stuff, you know, the insider attacks, and I say to myself, from what I've seen there and from people I've talked to, I can well believe that much of that is not some kind of infiltration from outside. It's people who have this rage inside them, and then one day they decide to do it.
So you're talking about Afghan soldiers being trained by Americans who then kill Americans.
Right.
Right.
And that is,
what did you hear about that? What else did you hear about that?
Well, I heard, I talked to a police officer, and he said, the guns the Americans give us jam after three firings. And that's because they're not really training us to be police. One day they'll turn on us and they will kill us all. Mm. And we won't be able to defend ourselves because they've planned it out already. The guns are going to jam. And he showed me a gun. And it was, you know, it looked like it came from Woolworth. It was like really light. And then he showed me what he said was, this is a real gun. And he showed me one that he had left over from his days when the Russians were there. And later I talked to somebody here, and he said, well, modern guns are made out of a light kind of material, and they're very delicate, and you have to have the right kind of ammunition for it. They don't jam, but only if you have the right ammo. And these guys did say, we took our guns and fired them 15 times at the wedding, and they jammed after three. And they got the bullets from the bazaar, I'm sure. But I'm just saying the rumor is false, but that's the kind of rumor that is spread, you know, that is floating around. And if that's what people are thinking, then I can imagine that there's a level of freaked outness.
Oh, right, and so much mistrust.
Mistrust, yeah.
Right. And I'm sure a lot of people have relatives and friends who have been killed, like, for example, the wedding bombings and things like this.
They have, although, you know, it's. I think it's important to say that what is going on in Afghanistan now, although it's very violent, there's a lot of violence, it is, again, like that situation of lots of crime. That's what it's like. It's not like a war, exactly. It's not like when the Soviets were there. You know, that was, it's really not right to suggest a parity between that situation and this situation, because that dismisses the severity and the horror of what happened when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. So we're not there. We're not even close to there. But we are in a situation where order is breaking down, and that's a question. How do you restore that?
We are speaking with Tamim Ansari about his new book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. And what he does in his book is tells the history of Afghanistan, but also gets past the stereotypes that we often get in the U.S. You know them, tribal people frozen in time, rugged mountains. He says that the history is not invasions, occupations, and interventions. It has a story of its own, which is interrupted by invasions, occupations, and interventions. So what questions do you have about the people's history of Afghanistan, where it is today? Tamim was just there last spring. And then what's in store for the country's future? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. To take part in today's conversation, please call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a message at yourcallradio.org.
is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Robert Reich, UC Berkeley professor, economist, and labor secretary under President Clinton. We will talk with him about where the U.S. economy is heading. There's so much debate about the deficit. He says the deficit should not be the goal. It should be about jobs, jobs, jobs. So how will austerity affect the economy in the coming years? And what questions do you have for Robert Reich? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, we'd love to hear from you. Feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Tamim Ansari. He's out with a new book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. He writes about the history of Afghanistan and the present. And then we're also talking about the fact that we really don't know where this is going. And if you have any questions about the history of Afghanistan, what are your thoughts about why the U.S. is there? Also, what did Tamim see when he was there last spring? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Paul in Berkeley. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum, Mir Tamim.
This sounds like Paul Overby. Is it?
It is indeed. If there are some tough guys in the cities, no doubt about that, and yeah. If there's some liberals in the countryside, still in the Pakhtunkhwa, in those areas occupied by Pashtuns,
yeah. Isn't
it true that after foreign withdrawal that the Taliban will remain as the most dynamic political military force in that area and probably take over at least part of that?
Well, you know, to some extent, they already have taken over those areas. And again, I would say Taliban is a dispersed sort of term. You know, in the old days, there was a particular entity that was the Taliban. And that was, you know, they had officers, they had a hierarchy. Now you have the Haqqani network, you have the guys in Quetta, you have what's his name from the past, Hikmat Yar is still running around, Molloy Tur. There's all the different networks. Will they take over in those areas? Hey, you know, that's the question of the age for that area. That line is that border is dissolving on both sides of that border. They're reverting to another era of governance and another way that the society operates. But you have to remember that nothing is permanent. You know, there is going to be a government in Kabul. That government in Kabul, if it emerges on its own, I don't think it's going to be necessarily very much like the government that is in Kabul right now, because a lot of people who are in you know, positions of political power in Afghanistan or are poised to become powerful, they share a lot of attitudes with people that you might call Taliban. So it's just not two distinct groups, I think.
Well, and I'm glad you raised this, because this often gets the most attention when you're talking to people, especially about women. Mm-hmm. And when I put the show on Facebook, someone wrote, it's the Taliban that are shutting down schools, executing women, giving the people a vision of their future. So you do hear this over and over again from Americans. How? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, if you substitute Taliban for the phrase something like reactionary right-wing, conservatives, then it's almost a tautology to say they're the ones who are executing women and shutting down schools. Yeah, they are. You know, that's almost the definition of reactionary right-wing rural conservative in Afghanistan. They're people who do not want those secular schools. They're people who do believe that life is governed by and should be governed by what they would say is the Sharia, which is a mixture of Afghan ancient tradition and the actual, dictates of the Islamic legislative and code of conduct system. And that's what they would embrace. So, yeah, those guys are the ones that that would be trying to shut down the secular schools. At the same time, they'd be trying to open their own schools, and they do. You know, they have this Haqqani network, which is a powerful Talibanist kind of network in northeastern Afghanistan, very deeply involved in, you know, drug running and every kind of criminal. They're a criminal syndicate, really. But part of their operation is that they have lots of madrasas. You know, they operate a lot of those things. Those are schools. They're schools that operate on the basis of the ideology that is powerful. Amongst those people.
Yeah, and they go back to the old ideology. They prevent women from going to school, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What about the reports that surfaced last month that President Hamid Karzai's aides met with delegates of the Taliban?
Well,
how do you read that?
You know, I think Karzai has been meeting with people on other parts of the political spectrum all along. Again, you know, Karzai is a guy that you would have to say his disassociation from the Taliban is not absolute. You know, he comes from Kandahar, the birthplace of the Taliban, and at one time he was friendly to them and connected with them at a time when the Taliban were first rising in Kandahar. So is he talking with the Taliban now? Hey, after this withdrawal, there's going to be jockeying for political power in Afghanistan. And the way that political questions of political power have been traditionally settled there is by building and having extensive networks of personal loyalty, fealty connections. And Karzai has been busy building those ever since he's been in office. A lot of those things that are a lot of those processes that are called corruption in the case of the Karzai administration are patronage that are designed to try to build that alternative system he can rely on after the U.S. leaves, because the elections and the democratic processes that the U.S. has put in place are largely mechanisms seen by Afghans as ways to get close to the money that's coming in into the country. So the actual power jockeying is not in terms of elections.
Well, what about who has the power here? Because you write about all of the Chinese money flooding in. You write about the NGOs, a ton of reconstruction money, and we'll talk about how so much of that has been squandered. So who really has the power here?
I'm sure that's a good question, and Afghans are asking that question. Who has the power in terms of what? Because there are to have access to the money is a way, is not disconnected from having power. Mm-hmm. There are elements from old Northern Alliance. There are elements that have connections to the South and the East and the Northeast, all those Pashtun areas. A lot of people have different ways that they have access to that money, and they up to now they've been using the election system to sort that out. People also have private armies still, and the question is, you know, who has power? You won't know that till there's a confrontation. All that stuff is in reserve, and we'll see. Now, I'll just mention, this year, when I sold my father's house to somebody in Afghanistan, he wanted it, and, you know, discovering that I had a house to sell, I went through the process. And then I said, well, are you going to move in here? And he said, no, I'm going to rent it. I'm going to, you know, mortgage it. Get a guy to occupy it for 2 years. I said, why 2 years? He said, because that's a Hazara neighborhood, and I'm a Tajik, and I don't want to be the only Tajik in a Hazara neighborhood on the day that NATO withdraws. Mm. So people have those kinds of concerns in their consciousness. Mm.
We're speaking with Tamim Ansari about his new book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Tamim was born in Afghanistan in 48. He moved to the U.S. in 64. He was there last spring. He's a San Francisco-based writer, author, and director of the San Francisco Writers Workshop. And Tamim wanted to get past the stereotypes that we see and hear in the media and really give us an arc, an overview of Afghans' history through the eyes of Afghans. What questions do you have about the history of Afghanistan, its present, its future? And then also, I mean, what the U.S. is still there, massive bases, green zone. Why do you think there's so much apathy toward what is happening in Afghanistan? I just did a quick Google search, and you hear about suicide bombing, and that's about it. You don't really get much more than that. Why is that? And what do you think it will take to maybe start a conversation about what's going on in Afghanistan? You hear things like, you know, President Obama saying we're going to leave, and what is it now, 2014? It changes often. But what are your thoughts on that? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And we have a few emails. Eric writes in, what do you think are the best and worst case scenarios for Afghanistan? And what can future U.S. dealings there do to improve the situation at this point?
Well, the worst case scenario is obviously a return or a reprise of the 1994 scenario when all the foreign people have left and Afghans are having a civil war amongst themselves. That was probably the worst of, well, you know, there's been so much bad that it's hard to say which is the worst, but that was one of the really bad periods of Afghan history. And many people fear that that's what could happen after the withdrawal. I think that that's probably not going to happen. And part of that is that this time there won't be the kind of withdrawal there was before. That was a post-Cold War withdrawal, and everyone said that part of the thing is over. We're all attention is going to be on Eastern Europe. That's where it's all happening. So really the attention of the big powers did go away from Afghanistan. This time that's not going to happen. And I think that, you know, the U.S. is, in fact, in the process of withdrawing most of its troops. I think the Obama idea is to reduce the military footprint of the United States in Afghanistan. But they're not going to give up the bases, and they're not going to withdraw all of the troops from those bases. But the military presence is going to be much more special forces-like.
How many bases at this point?
Well, it depends on what you call a base, but I don't know how many there are. There's a great big one at Bagram. There's a big one at Herat. There's a big one in Kandahar. There's one in the north, and then there's smaller ones that I think they're shutting down. They're congealing into the big bases. But as for the big bases, you know, when I was there in the spring and the talk was all of withdrawal, at the same time there was like 3 miles worth of trucks lined up with construction materials waiting to go in. And I talked to a guy who was stationed at the Herat base. He said, oh, they're busy building that as fast as they can go. So if they're building it, that means that they're not shutting it down, you know, and there's a lot of investment that has gone into those already. So so I don't think the bases are going to be shut down. The Chinese investment in the country right now is not, you know, they are securing the rights to lease and develop various minerals, and they're not involved militarily at all. So the question is, after the withdrawal, if their interests are threatened, then will China bring in military? I don't know.
And you write about this in your chapter, All That Glitters, yeah. And you point out that Afghanistan has the world's second largest unexploited deposits of copper. It has one of the largest deposits of unexploited high-grade iron, ore in all of Asia, gold and precious gems, cobalt, phosphorus, strontium, and uranium, plenty of natural gas, and even a small quantity of oil. So tell us a little bit about China. They, as you said, no committed troops, no military operation, so it's ironic that they're winning the rights to so much of the country's minerals.
All I can say is that is ironic, and they are winning it. And, you know, they are also building railroads into Afghanistan. India is the other country that has, that's successfully securing rights. There's a consortium of Indian companies that has got the rights to the iron. And they're building a railroad, too. They're building a railroad from that iron ore west across Iran to that port there. There's a railroad that goes north out of Mazar-e-Sharif into Uzbekistan. That's already operating. And they're still talking about, building a pipeline for oil and gas from Turkmenistan through Pakistan to India. So that stuff is happening.
Hmm.
The question for Afghans, however, is what power do they have to get any benefit from these minerals? And the question is not just in terms of what power do they have vis-a-vis the big foreign powers, but what structures and institutions do Afghans have to be able to benefit from them as a society rather than for the person who is standing next to the minerals with a title of, some government title, to be the one person who benefits. I think the institutions, unfortunately, are weak right now, so it's going to be dicey, though.
Because, as you write, this mining is supposed to begin in the next couple of years, right?
Yeah.
The Chinese had to stop because they agreed to basically hold off to let archaeologists complete excavations.
Well, that's a point of contention. The archaeological community says they claimed they held off for that, but actually there was going to be a period of getting ready anyhow, and they called that holding off, but actually they're not holding off at all. And they're holding off for 2 years, but really 10 is needed to secure the archaeological treasures.
So you've got the Chinese and the mining and the railroads, the Indians and the railroads. What about other neighboring countries, and what do you expect from Iran, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, for example?
Well, Pakistan is of course the big question for Afghanistan, and in part not so much because of Pakistan trying to invest in Afghanistan or anything like that. Pakistan now is in some trouble itself. I think it's a society that's having some trouble holding together, and this erosion of order that's occurred on both sides of that Durand line is as serious a problem. Well, I don't know if it's as serious, but it's a serious problem for Pakistan as it is for Afghanistan. Afghans, what their fear about Pakistan would be is about sabotage, infiltration, military incursions, and that is happening along that border. Iran has flexed economic muscle quite a bit, and there was a period recently when they closed the border between Iran and Afghanistan and stopped all the trucks from going in with fuel, and I think for no particular reason. It seems like it was just to demonstrate that, you guys, we could choke you off at any moment. And so Iran has that sort of a capacity. And they've sponsored lots of, like, trade shows and film festivals and things of that nature inside of Afghanistan to sort of, like, build cultural infiltration. Some Afghans would say that Shiism in Afghanistan at the last Shia holiday, Ashura, the big moment in the Shia period of mourning, the black flags were all over Kabul, whereas mostly that's a Sunni city. That was an indication of Iranian influence. I don't know if that's true, but that's just what Afghans have said. So Iran is also very involved in trying to assert that it can control Afghanistan, and you often hear statements coming out of Iran that Afghanistan is really historically a province of Iran, which sparks quite some indignation among Afghans when they hear that. And Iran is interested in having control of Afghanistan because the influx of drugs, of opium, out of Afghanistan into Iran is a huge problem for Iran. So, it goes both ways there.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Eric. And we have just about 7 minutes left with Tamim Ansari, author of Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Tamim, again, was born in Afghanistan in 1948. He moved to the U.S. in 64. He was there last spring. And if you have any questions for Tamim about what he saw there, the history of Afghanistan, where this is going, U.S. interests, pulling out militarily, but possibly using drones like they're using in Pakistan and Yemen, do you think?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. I wish that everybody, guests, hosts, etc., would not refer to the Afghanistan is going to do this and the Afghanistanis are that and the Pakistanis are this. From what I gather, the average individual is just trying to put food on the table and keep from freezing to death. And yet, we're really talking about what governments are doing. And I don't think anyone would contend that the Afghan government is representative of all of the Afghan people or the Pakistani government is. And if they just put the word government after they say the word Afghanistan or Pakistan, any more than if they say the U.S. is doing such and such, the U.S. government does such and such, not the individuals. And once we do that, we categorize people as identical in their interests and their needs with what the government is doing, we've built in a real distortion, I believe. And I'd appreciate the guest perspective on that.
Yeah, to some extent, I totally agree with you. And here's the thing. People are constantly asking me, what do Afghans feel about this? What do Afghans feel about that? It's like, well, which Afghans?
Right.
I don't think I go quite with what you're saying, because the government in Afghanistan is not really a government. There really is no government. There sort of is, but there's lots of Afghans, there's lots of power centers, there's lots of power interests, there's lots of fragmentation, and all of the fragments and so on have points to pursue and things they want to do. You're completely right that there is no way to characterize what all Afghans want or what Afghanistan is going to do. Afghanistan is not going to do anything. There are people in Afghanistan will do various things. I think if you look at people in Afghanistan going to do various things, you can still talk about what might likely happen in Afghanistan. But that's as far as you can go. I think you're right.
What would you like to say about maybe some of the dealings you had with ordinary Afghans and what they make of this? Did you have conversations with women, for example?
I did. But, you know, I just want to say, ordinary Afghans, I don't like that term.
Well, okay.
You know, it's
sort
of...
I'm talking just everyday Afghans
right.
who are, like he said, living their lives and whose lives have been greatly interrupted
right.
by not only these invasions, but also their own... Well, Hamid Karzai and his people.
Well, now, you know, it's when you say their lives have been interrupted, you're appealing to an idea that there is an ongoing life and it's been interrupted. We are in the fourth decade of a war that has destroyed the fabric of this country.
Right.
So there is no ordinary life. Everybody's scrambling. And they're scrambling in different ways. The second part of your question interested me. What did you say?
Women.
Oh, women. Well, you know, I have a little bit more contact with women than the ordinary person would have going to Afghanistan, just because I'm an Afghan, and so I know the women of my family. I see the women of my village. And I think one of the things I wanted to point out here, a little anecdote I want to tell, is that some of the Afghans I met were like, they wore suits, they deal with the Americans, they're very secular when they have to be. They're completely part of the modernist part of Afghanistan. But they have two wives. Or in the village, a guy said to me, yeah, I think I'll get a second wife. And I asked his first wife, what did you think? Because he said this with his first wife sitting there. And she said, well, if he gets a second wife, I'm going to choose that wife. And the first floor here is mine. She gets the second floor, if there is one. So it's a different idea, I think, of how that works than you would normally suppose on the outside. And this guy, who is so modernist, is also deeply ensconced in the other older system. So I think, you know, that's part of what I'm saying is that it's a muddy picture. There's not one thing or another.
Well, and we had an email from Rich who says the most common excuse I hear for U.S. intervention is the status of women.
And there is a great deal of energy amongst women in Afghanistan on the modernist side to produce some change. And there has been for, you know, decades. That impulse exists in Afghanistan. I just know that the period in which it mostly advanced, the greatest progress was made in that period when Afghanistan had found a way to carve out the greatest amount of autonomy as a country. So that's when it happened.
Mm. We have about a minute left. Final thoughts?
Final thoughts. Oh, my gosh, you got me on the spot here. the only thing I'll say is that when I left Afghanistan this spring, I said, oh, that was so tense. I don't think I'll go back. And 2 weeks after I was here, I was like, man, that was so interesting. I think I'll go back. So I think I might go back this spring.
You should definitely go back.
Yeah, I will.
Tamim Ansari is author of The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan, Games Without Rules. You can find his work and his writings at our website, yourcallradio.org. You've got a number of events coming up in the Bay Area over the next few months.
Well, I have Burton Beckett on February 6th, so 7 o'clock, people should come to that. I forget what else.
Well, you have a lot in February.
I do have a lot in February. My website, www.mirtamimansori.com, they should all be listed there.
Great, and it is on our website also, yourcallradio.org. Tamim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. Where is the U.S. economy heading? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Robert Reich, UC Berkeley professor, economist, and former Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. The recent debate in Washington has revolved around reducing the deficit, but Reich says jobs must be the goal, not deficit reduction. So what's behind the push to cut the deficit? What programs are at risk? How will austerity plans affect the economy in the coming years? And what are the alternatives? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Hello, this is Chuck Feeney of Your Legal Rights. If you have questions about student rights with respect to school districts or questions about eligibility for special education services, please join me this Wednesday evening at 7 on Your Legal Rights. My guest will be Peter Sturges, who specializes in education law. And if you have a question, please plan to call in. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 on Your Legal Rights here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Ben James. This is an international conversation open to you live on the BBC.
However, we will not negotiate with people with extremist ideas and whose language is only killing and terrorism.
What did you think of the speech by Syria's President Assad? It was his first public address since June in front of an audience at Damascus Opera House. He talked about those opposing him and set out his idea for a political solution. You're responding to what he said at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. Also, would you ever change your nationality? The actor Gérard Depardieu has accepted a Russian passport. He's upset at the French government's plans for high taxes on high earners. Under what circumstances would you seek citizenship elsewhere? You can tweet as you listen. The hashtag is WHYS.